Some Kids Left Behind. This is Joe Zadroga, father of NYPD Detective James Zadroga, and the remarkable, should have won the Pulitzer Prize, Juan Gonzalez. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.
Supported community radio, KBOO Portland.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available at our website at kboo.fm. Due to temporary closure of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available at our website. The Personnel Committee meets on the second Monday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.
And now, your daily volunteer-produced community newscast, the KBOO Evening News.
Coming up on the KBOO Evening News. Oregon reports 54 COVID deaths over Labor Day weekend. Portland District Attorney Mike Schmidt releases memos explaining no charges for 12 Portland officers. And Mondelez International sends a cease and desist letter to the local bakers union pledging legal action. Good evening. This is the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 7th, 2021. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu. The coronavirus Delta variant continues to surge across Oregon, with 5,821 new COVID-19 cases reported over Labor Day weekend. 54 more deaths were recorded between September 3rd and 6th, bringing the state's total death toll up to 3,326 people. Currently, 1,140 people are hospitalized due to the virus, including 300 patients in intensive care units. There are just 57 ICU beds available across the state as hospitals are inundated with COVID-19 patients. Oregon is administering, on average, about 8,700 doses of a COVID vaccine per day. According to new data released by the Oregon Health Authority, nearly 4 in 5 coronavirus deaths in Oregon during the first 4 weeks of August were among unvaccinated or partially vaccinated individuals. The share of so-called breakthrough cases and deaths among fully vaccinated Oregonians remains tiny compared to the 2.4 million Oregonians who were fully vaccinated as of late August. Since the start of the pandemic, the state has identified 13,166 breakthrough cases, defined as a person who tests positive 14 days or later after receiving the full course of vaccinations, which is 2 shots of Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna, or 1 shot of the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. That's slightly more than 0.5% who have been infected with the disease after being fully vaccinated. The OHA's latest data also shows that most of the fatalities among vaccinated people occurred in August, one of the state's deadliest months since the start of the pandemic. Before August, the state had identified only 43 fully vaccinated people who died of COVID-19. In the first 4 weeks of August, the state tallied the deaths of 70 fully vaccinated people, which accounted for 22% of the COVID-19-related fatalities in August. Breakthrough cases have become a growing concern as the Delta variant overtakes the nation and most of the world. Although public health experts and epidemiologists say the vaccines offer enormous protection against hospitalization and death, even from Delta, their effectiveness wanes over time. 2 weeks ago, the Biden administration announced that most Americans who have been fully vaccinated against COVID-19 with two shots of Pfizer-BioNTech or Moderna should receive a booster shot 8 months later, starting September 20th. Although those plans remain in flux. The Nabisco strike that began August 10th when union bakers walked out of the factory along Northeast Columbia Boulevard is still unresolved. Nabisco's parent company, Mondelez International, has even taken aggressive steps to combat the strikers' tactics and keep its operations running. Nearly 200 members from the Bakery, Confectionery, Tobacco Workers, and Grain Millers International Union Local 364 went on strike nearly a month ago to protest Mondelez's proposed new contract. The union says the contract would strip away overtime pay and provide less robust health coverage. Every day since, strikers have waved homemade signs, wielded bullhorns, and cheered at cars whizzing along the major roads where the bakery sits. On August 31st, Mondelez sent a cease and desist letter to the union warning strikers that the company would pursue legal action if they did not stop interfering with plant operations. Since late August, a rotating group of strikers has occupied space near the Union Pacific Railroad tracks to stop incoming trains carrying cooking oil, sugar, and flour. Unionized railroad workers have honored the baker's picket line. Then, on September 2nd, Portland police kicked strikers off the property next to the railroad tracks, where they had positioned themselves to block trains carrying supplies. The Portland strikers touched off strikes at other Mondelez bakeries and distribution centers across the country. And it comes at a time when Americans stuck at home during the COVID-19 pandemic are loading up on snacks like Nabisco products. It also comes at a time when skilled laborers, such as bakers, are in high demand. The Multnomah County District Attorney's Office announced Friday that at least three Portland police officers, under investigation for incidents during last summer's historic racial justice protests, will not face criminal prosecution. Prosecutors' memos note the district attorney's office had 21 cases under review that alleged police used excessive force and also took people's personal property during protests. On Friday, the district attorney's office said it would close 12 of those cases, either because attorneys and victims did not cooperate, the officers could not be identified, or the district attorney's office found no crime was committed. Multnomah County District Attorney Mike Schmidt told OPB, quote, "The law is on a police officer's side in doing their job. They can use force, so for us, the analysis is the use of force not allowed by law? Is it so excessive that we could prove beyond a reasonable doubt that they are not allowed to use that amount of force?" End quote. Schmidt decided that he likely could not make that point in court for the cases he closed. The dropped cases represent a tiny fraction of the police violence captured on video and shared online last summer, which shocked the city's conscience night after night. While dozens of protesters have faced criminal prosecution in state court, Portland appears to have disregarded a federal Justice Department recommendation to hold lieutenants and higher-ranking officers accountable for last summer's use of force violations. The effects of wildfire season on air quality outside are obvious, but hidden impacts on air quality are also lurking inside some homes. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
Wildfire season has obvious effects on air quality outside, but hidden impacts on air quality also are lurking inside some homes. Environmental and health groups, as well as the Oregon Health Authority, are warning about burning natural gas inside, such as from gas stoves. The Oregon Environmental Council's Jamie Pang South says cooking with fossil fuel-based gas appliances release nitrous oxide, carbon monoxide, methane, and small particulate matter.
That can cause anything from headaches, nausea, fatigue. There's this new study from Powpast Track Gas that children in homes with gas stoves have a 42% increase of asthma.
Pang South has used an air quality monitor to measure carbon dioxide levels while cooking on a gas stove and found concentrations reaching unhealthy levels after 20 minutes of cooking. One way to reduce levels of hazardous gases is opening windows, but that can be impossible during Oregon's increasingly severe wildfire seasons. Vivek Shandis is a professor of urban studies and planning at Portland State University. He's concerned about folks who have to work outside or take public transportation in these conditions. Shandis wants to improve the health of the state's most vulnerable community members.
Who are seeing the brunt of not only the wildfire consuming their homes and their belongings, we're also seeing those whose homes and belongings aren't consumed by the wildfires inhaling a lot of the really degraded air.
Barbara Gottlieb is with Physicians for Social Responsibility, which is also raising the alarm about the effects from gas appliances. She says one solution is building out electrification.
What it aims to do is to rethink our buildings, our structures, so that they're not being built with either gas furnaces or gas water heaters or gas stoves, but from the start they are electric.
Gottlieb adds that this cuts down on indoor air pollution and that the source of energy for electric appliances increasingly is from clean sources like solar and wind. I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
The case of a St. Paul, Minnesota man who was recently acquitted on charges of attempted murder is still raising questions about police and prosecutorial fairness. With more on the story, it's Faven Garazgahar with the Racial Reckoning Project.
The case of a St. Paul man recently acquitted on charges of attempted murder is still raising questions about police and prosecutorial fairness. 29-year-old Jaleel Stallings had been charged with shooting at police during protests following the murder of George Floyd. No officers were injured. The Minnesota Reformer acquired body camera footage that supported Stallings' version of events.
Listen, Sam. Put your hands on your back! I'm crying.
Stallings claimed self-defense, noting he thought officers were white supremacists patrolling Lake Street. The body camera videos show police shooting rubber bullets at people from an unmarked van without lights. The videos also show Stallings lying on the ground after officers identified themselves. Then you see police punching and kicking him. Michelle Gross is with Communities United Against Police Brutality.
The stuff that was coming out of these cops' mouths is, like, reprehensible. But it's a good way to get a kind of a backroom view, if you will, of the way that cops really think about the community and the way that they operate.
Gross shared the video with the U.S. Department of Justice, which is investigating the Minneapolis Police Department for use of excessive force. She said she's glad Stallings was acquitted, but questioned why the county attorney brought the case to trial.
The prosecutor had access to that body camera footage. The prosecutor had all of that information available to them. Why would you go forward with a prosecution given what you've seen? You know, I think most people don't think about it this way, but use of the criminal justice system against people is a form of retaliation.
Minneapolis authorities say they are conducting an internal review of the involved police officers. A hearing to decide whether to release more body camera footage will take place later this month. For the Racial Reckoning Project, I'm Faven Garazgahar.
Racial Reckoning, the Arc of Justice, is produced and supported by Ampers, diverse radio for Minnesota's communities, in partnership with KMLJ Radio and the Minnesota Humanities Center.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News. Stay tuned after this newscast for an in-depth report on increasing the role of migrants in national politics, followed by COVID Noise Filter, debunking the coronavirus pandemic. Then at 6, it's Transpositive PDX. And at 7, Hard Knock Radio. Tonight's weather will be mostly clear skies with a few clouds and a low of 66 degrees. Tomorrow will be partly cloudy with a high of 87 degrees. Today in history, in 1977, President Jimmy Carter and Panamanian dictator Omar Torrijos sign a treaty agreeing to transfer control of the Panama Canal from the U.S. to Panama at the end of the 20th century. The quote of the day is from American abolitionist and women's rights activist Sojourner Truth, who said, quote, "Truth is powerful and it prevails." Federal emergency unemployment benefits expire. The Department of Justice says it will challenge the new Texas abortion law, and charter planes with passengers seeking to flee the Taliban are held up leaving Afghanistan. With more on the story, it's Nadia Ramlagan with 2021 Talks.
Welcome to 2021 Talks, where we're following our democracy in historic times.
Far too many of these workers died because they did not have basic protections. They didn't have a government that was on their side.
Ohio Democratic Senator and Banking Committee Chair Sherrod Brown says an unprecedented number of frontline workers died on the job this year from COVID-19. Brown testified Monday at a Senate Banking, Housing, and Urban Affairs Committee virtual hearing on workers' rights and the government's role in protecting workers. More than 7 million Americans lost their emergency federal unemployment benefits yesterday. 26 states pulled out of the extra $300 in unemployment income earlier this summer as businesses struggled to fill job openings. The White House says there are no plans to expand federal unemployment benefits any further. Executive Director at the National Black Workers Center, Tanya Wallace, says the decision will particularly affect workers of color.
Racism, unemployment, and low-wage work are multipliers of inequity that are experienced by families already struggling with poverty.
Over the weekend, President Biden approved disaster declarations for New York and New Jersey. New York Governor Kathy Hochul said Ida caused more than $50 million in damages after the storm's record-breaking rainfall of 3.1 inches per hour last week. New York had 17 confirmed deaths, and in New Jersey, there were at least 27 confirmed deaths and 4 people missing. Biden is expected to visit the region today. Kentucky Governor Andy Beshear says his state is now in a dire situation because of a surge in new coronavirus cases driven by the Delta variant. Meanwhile, health professionals are concerned misinformation may be leading pregnant women to choose not to get the COVID vaccine despite universal recommendations from medical groups that they do so. Dr. Jessica Branham is an OBGYN at Appalachian Regional Healthcare in the eastern part of the state.
We have tons and tons of good data showing that women who are pregnant have received their COVID-19 vaccine and that they are not only doing well, but it is actually showing protective effect for the newborn baby as well.
The Department of Justice on Monday said it will provide support for women who are seeking abortions in Texas amid turmoil following the passage of a controversial restrictive abortion law in the state. Attorney General Merrick Garland said the department will explore all options to challenge the new Texas law. Finally, at least 4 planes chartered to evacuate several hundred people seeking to escape the Taliban's takeover of Afghanistan have been unable to leave the country for days, officials said Sunday. Republican Representative Michael McCaul of Texas said the Taliban was preventing Americans from leaving. Afghan officials say the passengers were Afghans, many of whom lacked passports or visas. I'm Nadia Ramlagan for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our 8 trust indicators to support transparency and accuracy at publicnewsservice.org.
States have passed laws that increase penalties for protesters of critical infrastructure, primarily as a result of oil pipeline protests. Indigenous advocates say these laws could also infringe on the religious rights of Native Americans. Eric Tegedoff has more on the story with the Public News Service.
State legislatures across the country have passed laws criminalizing an essential part of civic participation in a democracy. protesting. According to one expert, these laws also could infringe on the religious rights of Native Americans. A measure passed in Montana this year is designed to protect critical infrastructure like oil pipelines. Rosalind Lapierre, who teaches environmental studies at the University of Montana, says if someone is convicted under this law, they could be fined up to $150,000 and spend 30 years in prison.
What is different about the Montana law and a few other laws is that the Montana law also includes people who assist protesters.
Lapierre says many states have borrowed similar language to punish protesters and people who aid them. She believes the laws are in response to protests of the Dakota Access Pipeline at Standing Rock and to prevent actions like the Keystone XL pipeline protests, a project that was proposed to run through Montana. Lapierre says the people who gathered at Standing Rock saw themselves more as protectors of the land than protesters. She says Native Americans treat the land as sacred, and the places where these demonstrations take place are comparable to church.
They're coming in and they're praying there. They're coming in and they're blessing the place. They're coming in and they may be having a ritual or a ceremony there. And that is just in accordance with the tradition or the culture of that particular area.
The 1978 American Indian Religious Freedom Act allowed indigenous people to exercise their traditional religions. But Lapierre notes the law often isn't held up in court. She adds laws that make it harder to protest also erode the American tradition of civil disobedience, which has been a tenet of the society since Boston Tea Party protesters broke the law at the country's founding.
Today, with these anti-protesting laws, what we are saying is that civil disobedience is no longer something that we want to occur in the United States. It's no longer a value that we hold in the United States.
I'm Eric Tegedoff reporting.
A federal judge strikes down a Trump-era water rule, and the Cherokee Nation principal chief vows to protect the U.S. Supreme Court's McGirt decision. With that story and more, it's Antonia Gonzalez with National Native News, the daily newscast dedicated to Indigenous news, issues, and culture.
This is National Native News. I'm Antonia Gonzalez. A federal judge in Arizona recently struck down a Trump-era water rule, which reduced the number of waterways protected under federal regulations. Emma Gibson from Arizona Public Media reports the lawsuit against the Environmental Protection Agency was filed by six federally recognized tribes from across the country.
Though the Biden administration found serious issues with Trump's water rule, it was going to use it till they could come up with their own policy. Since it's been struck down, protections are back on for ephemeral streams, which only flow after rain or snow. In Arizona, that's over 90% of the waterways. Chairman Peter Yucopicio leads the Pascuayaki tribe in the southern part of the state.
And this is just one more way of the tribes banding together and getting that powerful feeling that you can do something about it, regardless if it's somebody as high as the president and all that.
Yucopicio seems hopeful that the ruling will strengthen efforts to protect waters within a proposed copper mine site in southern Arizona. For National Native News, I'm Emma Gibson.
Arizona Governor Doug Ducey has signed a bill into law that guarantees students the right to wear Native American cultural dress and items at graduation ceremonies. As Arizona Public Radio's Ryan Heinches reports, some students in the state say school district dress codes have prevented them from wearing such items.
Under Arizona law, schools were already barred from preventing students from wearing religious or cultural objects or dress during extracurricular activities. But the new measure expands state law to include items of indigenous importance. State Representative and Navajo tribal member Jasmine Blackwater Nigren sponsored the bill.
When we wear our traditional regalia, it really allows us to celebrate who we are as our full selves, right? Not just who we are as a student, but who we are as Native students.
Blackwater Nigren, who herself wore traditional regalia to her high school, college, and law school commencements, points out that Native Americans have the lowest graduation rates of any group in the nation. The ceremonies are particularly important for Indigenous graduates, their families, and their communities. A school district in Maricopa County was sued last year after a Native American student was denied entry to her graduation ceremony because she was wearing a traditionally beaded cap with a sacred eagle plume.
That was Ryan Heinches. On Friday, the Cheyenne and Arapaho tribes and the Clinton, Oklahoma Public School District released a joint statement saying a reported incident involving the cutting of a Native student's hair by other students is inaccurate. Tribal and school leaders met last week, and an investigation began following a report that an elementary student had his hair cut by two older students without his consent. The report, which was widely circulated across social media, angered the Native community, and calls for action quickly followed. According to the tribal and school statement, video shows the student entering and exiting the restroom alone and not with two older students. School officials say the investigation will continue. Over the weekend, in a State of the Nation address, Cherokee Nation of Oklahoma Principal Chief Chuck Hoskin Jr. vowed to continue to protect tribal sovereignty and seize opportunities through the U.S. Supreme Court's McGirt decision. The decision affirms reservation boundaries and has been a contentious issue between the state's governor and tribes. Hoskin, in his speech, said directly to the governor of Oklahoma that the Cherokee Nation needs to be treated with respect and they're ready to resolve challenges, but called the governor ill-informed for insisting that McGirt is a crisis. Hoskin says this needs to be resolved. Oklahoma Governor Kevin Stitt has publicly criticized the McGirt ruling. Hoskin also says the Cherokee Nation will resist any effort in Congress to erode McGirt. I'm Antonia Gonzalez.
A young activist is working to shut down oil drilling across Los Angeles. Nearly 600,000 people in LA County live within a quarter mile of an active oil or gas well. Dr. Anthony Lizowitz has more on the story with Climate Connections.
I'm Dr. Anthony Lizowitz, and this is Climate Connections. Nayeli Kobo was 9 years old when she started experiencing headaches, nosebleeds, asthma attacks, and other ailments.
I suffered a lot health-wise.
Her symptoms coincided with a major increase in activity at an oil well across the street from her home in South Central LA. Oil drilling uses toxic chemicals that can be hazardous to human health when breathed. Other people in Kobo's neighborhood were complaining of similar symptoms, so the community launched a campaign to stop what she says is a dire and preventable health hazard.
We don't need to rely on fossil fuels anymore. There's no need to be drilling where we're living.
In 2013, after 3 years of community pressure and growing scrutiny from public officials, the oil company shut down the site near Kobo's home indefinitely. Now Kobo is 20, and she's helping push for a citywide phase-out of all oil drilling.
There's so many people and so many wells that are in our area.
Nearly 600,000 people in Los Angeles County live within a quarter mile of an active oil or gas well. So Kobo shares her story as she fights for a future in which all Los Angeles residents can breathe clean air. Climate Connections is produced by the Yale Center for Environmental Communication. To hear more stories like this, visit climateconnections.org.
You're listening to the KBOO Evening News for Tuesday, September 7th, 2021. Call or text us with your breaking news stories and tips at 971-245-2158. The producer for tonight's newscast is Yasmin Kobanoglu, and our engineer is Otto. Special thanks to Faven Garazgahar, Antonia Gonzalez, Nadia Romlagan, Eric Tegadoff, and Dr. Anthony Lizowitz. The director of Evening News is Althea Billings. A podcast of this newscast is available on our website at kboo.fm/eveningnews. You're listening to KBOO Portland on 90.7 FM, K282BH Philomath on 104.3 FM, and K220HR Hood River on 91.9 FM. I'm Yasmin Kobanoglu, coming up tomorrow morning on KBOO. At 8, it's Wednesday Talk Radio, news and commentary on local, national, and international issues. At 9, Inside Washington County with Rob Solomon brings residents the information they need to fully engage with issues in their community. At 9:30, it's Culture in Motion with Mike Crenshaw, covering art, culture, and politics with hip-hop as the guiding light. At 10, it's the Children's Hour, featuring educational and entertaining programming for listeners of all ages. Then at 11, it's The Dirtbag. Host Glenn Anderson is joined by Jim Gilbert to talk about cover crops, winter squash, and the benefits of a plant-based diet. All of these KBOO programs, including the evening news, are made possible by support from our members. If you'd like to become a member and support our programming, you can go to kboo.fm/give or text KBOO to 44321. Stay tuned now for an in-depth report on increasing the role of migrants in national politics.
KBOO News In Depth, where we take a deeper look at the top news stories impacting our community.
Farm workers from Mexico and other parts of Central America gathered at the Mexican consulate in Woodburn, Oregon, Saturday. The crowd met representatives from Mexico's Morena Party, who arrived at Portland International Airport earlier that day. The party had recently recognized its Oregon branch and were visiting to speak with Mexican citizens living in the diaspora. The Morena Party is currently the most powerful in Mexican federal politics. The populist, left-wing movement is inseparably associated with its founder and president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, more commonly referenced by the nickname AMLO. The meeting took place in a crowded conference room on the second floor of the consulate. Participants represented not just Mexicans living in Oregon, but also residents of Arizona, Texas, California, and other states. Mexican migrants and immigrants in Oregon often encounter exploitation from their employers and perennial instability from U.S. immigration policies. Many feel that the Mexican consulate hasn't responded adequately to their concerns last year. Maria Silva is a Moreno Party member living in Oregon.
So we're part of the president's political party, Morena, Movimiento Regeneración Nacional, and we are here to give that opportunity to people to register or not. We're also going to be taking claims and complaints about the Mexican consulate because people are trying to go bury their people that are dying from COVID, and the consulates are not really right now communicating effectively with people, so we'll see. It was good, but then there was some changes, and then the communication just dropped. We haven't had a lot of contact and communication, and that's what we're trying to pick up. I know our president of Mexico, Andrés Manuel López Obrador, we call him AMLO. He's working really hard to make sure that there is good services for the people, but with COVID and all the restrictions and the protocols, we don't know who dropped the ball or what happened. So that's what we're trying to figure out what happened.
The Morena Party visitors distributed pamphlets and delivered speeches to the crowd, encouraging them to develop local committees under the banner of the party to advocate for their rights. Aside from issues affecting Mexican residents of the United States, party officials hope to increase electoral participation from Mexicans abroad. A recent law that passed Mexico's Congress with Morena's support gives Mexicans an opportunity to recall a president halfway through a 6-year term. Maria believes Mexicans in the United States should be part of that process.
They just passed in the Congress the new law which the people of Mexico can revoke any president, meaning like their term is 6 years, so after 3 years, they're going to call for a forum, official forum, where people can vote and decide and say, yes, this president is doing really good. We want him to stay another 3 years, or no, we want him back and let's get a new president. So that's the revoca de mandato. So he just got passed. Of course, we love our president. We want him to stay. We will vote for him next year, next March 2022. And we're very confident he's going to win, but we're doing this, he's doing this, because in the future, let's say another Trump comes, right? So if there is other of the presidents that have been stealing and corrupting Mexico for the last 100 years, if they try to come back, the people should be able in 3 years to tell if they're doing good, if they're not doing good, if they get the boot, or if they get to stay. So that's the reason why we want to make sure that people have the opportunity to vote in that very important decision, but they cannot make that decision and vote if they're not registered into the voting system. The president knows, the president of Mexico knows that we are sustaining Mexican country's economy. We send thousands and thousands of dollars to Mexico every day. And we are part of the economy of Mexico. If we're not the first one after the oil, we are a very important part of the economy. And we need to be able to have a say in the politics and what's going on. That's why we're trying to, you know, gain recognition, to be recognized, and to have the systems to institutionally to be able to vote in decisions that are affecting Mexico.
Have you been ignored, do you feel?
We were ignored for hundreds of years.
Morena Party officials emphasize the benefits of international cooperation between Latin American states. Leonidas Salazar is a longtime Oregon resident from Peru who also sees Mexico as a leader in reform politics.
I'm a Morena member since 2017. I'm from Peru, but the Mexican political party, the president what they have right now, is the number one man on all over the world. I'm listening to his meeting in the mornings every day since he was in the president elect at the first day. So I'm a Morena Oregon on a social media, cooperate because I like what he's doing for his people. He's fighting every single day for people. They always was in a poor situation. He's trying to give them back what they supposed to be the government has to do for them. And I like what he's doing. He's reporting what he's working every single day. He start work at 5 a.m, like me, like everyone. And he's honest. He is like, to me, the second Jesus Christ I know. And on my country, it was the election in last June. And the president now, it's the guy who's following his directions. Peru, I hope he'll get better because Andres Lopez Obrador is doing a good job and we are following him. We like them.
Also attending were several Mixtecs from Oaxaca, a remote state in southern Mexico. Their community faces unique obstacles from lack of infrastructure to a language barrier that makes it difficult to communicate with the state. A woman named Carmen translated from Mixtec for two Mixtec men.
My name is Carmen. I'm indigenous, the same community, close, but now, okay. In this town, San Mateo Tunuchi. The city is San Mateo Tunuchi from Oaxaca, La Mixteca. But the town of San Mateo, they have problem about the tierra,
Earth.
That's a big issue, but he want to the president, government president, he want to came to the San Mateo to fix those problems. He want to services for the phone because everybody had a cell phone, right? But no signs. You need to come from Ocuapan de Leon or city, big city, where you need to contact for your family, right? That's what he want to fix those problems. He asking for the phone, asking for the problem for the parcelas that the different town. They not electricity too. That's why asking to the government president Lopez Obrador, he said he need to come see the small town, how poor is the people there. No electricity. Agua potable, no water to just that each people go to the small looking water, nothing. When the weather is very heavy there, the street is coming down a lot. They want to fix that one. Yeah, okay. That's only thing he's asking. The school.
The
need to the school for the kindergarten. I asking for chair, for table, because we have a school now, but no cover. It's in the air, like here, right? That's why the big issue this community. It's a indigenous community. That's why asking for the government for to go fix, provide to the school for the children or something like that.
And has there been a response from the government?
For me?
Has there been a response from the government?
Acercando, si mi che presidente ha toccando in deva. It can't chat because the language very, okay. Right? That's a big issue for them. But the whole community for speak only Mixteco. No read, no write. That's very issue. A lot of community do that, like mine too. It's the same issue. Yeah, we had a lot of trouble when the rain is very, very heavy, but the street is closed, the dirt coming down, it can't go, nobody fixed that. We had a lot of problems.
You know, millions of immigrants from Mexico here, brothers and sisters, is because there was all these prior governments that stole and corrupted Mexico, and they deny us the opportunity to live in peace in our own country, in Mexico. We don't want to be here. We don't want to come here to the United States, but we don't have a choice.
It was a lot of poor in my country when I decided to come in this country to give a better life to my little child. And some of my cousins was an opportunity to bring me here, and they told me, let's go there because you can give a better life to my daughter. A lot of things what they told me, it wasn't true. It was a lie because in here, they never mentioned I have to work since this time to pay a rent, to pay all kind of the food what I need, the ride, everything. So they just mentioned you can earn money and you can send your family. Of course I did it, but it was hard because it was not easy to find a job.
When you live in Mexico and there's no roads, no schools, no jobs, no opportunity, you cannot raise a family just in dreams. So we are just like very grateful that the president had a dream. He created a new political party similar to Bernie Sanders. It's like a social democracy, and he's thinking always in the people in the bottom. He's always focusing on the needs. His work is pretty much equity work. So it's not to give everyone the same, but it's to give the most to the one who have been lacking and who needed the most.
You've been listening to interviews from the Morena Party rally, the Mexican consulate in Woodburn, Oregon. These were recorded last Saturday. From KBOO News, I'm Ethan Sandweiss.
Hi, my name is Dr. Mark Allen Derry, and I'm an infectious diseases specialist in New Orleans.
Hi, my name is Doc Griggs, and I'm a community medicine doctor and health literacy expert. This is the Noise Filter Podcast, where an infectious diseases physician...
That's me, and a health literacy and communications expert...
That's me, talk about what you need to know about COVID-19.
You can find more information about this show and our other daily live updates and Q&A show at noisefiltershow.com.
So let's get started.
COVID-19 vaccination plans and equitable distribution. As a response to the COVID-19 pandemic, U.S. states have had to come up with plans for their vaccine distribution once COVID-19 vaccines were approved for emergency use by the FDA. The National Academies of Science, Engineering, and Medicine then had to come up with a framework to assist policymakers in planning for equitable vaccine allocation. A recent study by a team of researchers led by Dr. Juan C. Rojas at the University of Chicago examines how states in the U.S. subsequently plan to ensure equitable vaccine distribution. The study evaluates 51 COVID-19 distribution plans, one plan for each state and Washington, D.C., in order to determine which states planned for vaccine equity. States employ different criteria to determine what constituted a high-risk medical condition and therefore which groups would receive priority vaccine access. In some states, people aged over 65 were prioritized. In others, it was people over the age of 75. In addition, the most common conditions which were deemed high risk across most states were diabetes and obesity. While these diseases were indeed high risk, sickle cell disease, which disproportionately affects African Americans, was only listed as a high risk condition in less than 3/4 of state plans. This is a disproportionate impact on minority populations in the U.S. and how they're affected by COVID-19, thus exacerbating existing racial health disparities. Minority populations have approximately 5 times the greater risk of adverse COVID-19 complications and also tend to suffer from limited access to healthcare, socioeconomic difficulties, and unfortunately, racism. Plans for equitable vaccine distribution would ultimately help lessen the burden of the pandemic on minorities and under-resourced communities. However, only 21 states created health equity committees, and of these 20 states, only 8 included minority group representatives. Dr. Rojas's team acknowledged that some state plans were in their early stages and that vaccine rollout efforts would likely continue to be adjusted and updated. Their study concludes with the aim that it will help inform ongoing equitable vaccination distribution efforts and that it would be used to guide policies for potential healthcare crises in the future. The current administration has made reducing health disparities one of its key aims, and equitable vaccine distribution would help to minimize these gaps. Vaccine distribution is an ongoing process, and with greater numbers of people getting vaccinated and increasing ease of access to vaccines, minority populations will hopefully receive their fair share of vaccinations as states continue to adjust their plans. Grief support through religion and spirituality in the pandemic. Now, the pandemic has brought forward painful heartbreaks and grief as people continue to lose loved ones to COVID-19. Now, under normal circumstances, many people turn to faith leaders to find solace and healing during the grieving of a loss. Now, with COVID-19, this process has been halted as community gatherings are still not permissible.
Funeral proceedings, among other events which help people navigate through grief, have been limited due to the continued threat of coronavirus. Given these challenges, faith leaders across different religions and spiritual beliefs have adapted to provide support through faith in new ways.
That's right. In fact, Pastor Patrick Young hosts a congregation of 350 people in New York. The congregation has not come together in person for over a year. But during the pandemic, several members of the church did pass away from COVID. On the other hand, most of his congregation knew someone who passed away from COVID. And as the numbers grew, Pastor Young decided to start a fireside chat weekly on Thursdays, in which he does a phone call with the entire congregation.
During these calls, he includes a segment called Faith Through the Pandemic to allow his congregation to grieve, vent, or simply talk out the collective emotions and feelings they are experiencing. Though they cannot congregate in person, he offers these phone calls as a means to continue community support through their shared faith.
In Los Angeles, Rabbi Jason Weiner is a chaplain at a hospital. He explains that hospital chaplains have a particularly challenging job as they're constantly surrounded by death within the hospital. Huh, imagine that. A chaplain has a difficult job because they're surrounded by death in the hospital. That's something that Julie and I can talk about all day long.
Oh, yeah.
Many families who lose loved ones display an array of emotions that grief brings on. Sometimes the family members feel anger or distrust with God or frustration with the unwanted circumstances before them.
Rabbi Weiner explains that his role is to help ground these families in these moments of grief. He offers his compassion and love and tries to help soothe the tension experienced after a loss of a loved one.
So we're collectively experiencing grief across the globe right now, and many are not able to fully go through the process of grief as COVID-19 continues to produce more grief before we can heal from prior losses. Faith leaders and representatives have been challenged to discover ways in which they can still offer spiritual support under new restrictions that the pandemic has brought.
Many have adapted to institute new facets of supportive systems within faith-based communities. The underlying message is that no one is in this alone. Faith leaders want to remind people that their emotions are valid and there is space to work through their grief process and begin to heal, even if the space is virtual for the time being.
Indeed. Health organizations use digital mapping tools to aid pandemic response. For many health organizations, pandemic response has been a question of location, identifying where COVID transmission is highest and where vaccination and testing may be lagging in order to effectively deploy limited services. According to the New York Times, many public health experts have been using geospatial data to get this information. Most of this data is visualized through tools like geographic information systems or GIS software in order to create easy-to-digest maps of things like case and vaccination rates. This kind of mapping has already been very useful across the country. In New York, Suffolk County, digital mapping helped the government's pandemic response team to identify low vaccination rates in neighborhoods where English was a second language. Using this data, they added Spanish and Haitian Creole to their vaccine hotline, and the vaccination rate in those neighborhoods increased. Count me in, former Georgia gubernatorial candidate Stacey Abrams' vaccination campaign uses GIS data to overcome issues of accessibility to the vaccine as well. The initiative maps vaccination sites across Georgia and compares them to data on possible obstacles to getting the vaccine, such as low rates of car ownership or computer access. Then Count Me In was also able to send mobile vaccine clinics to areas that had few clinics and high barriers to access. They began canvassing in those areas, hoping to book more than 4,000 vaccine appointments. According to the New York Times, geospatial data can be also helpful to logistic companies that handle the vaccines themselves. In the U.S., many states have large rural counties where vaccination sites can be hard to access for many people, including those with disabilities, that keep them going at home. Using digital mapping, these counties were able to map requests for online appointments in order to minimize waste and maximize the number of shots they can deliver. What our brains say about long-term effects of COVID-19? 8.4 million. That's the estimated number of people who've contracted coronavirus and may not be able to overcome the lasting physical effects of COVID-19. Researchers from the National Institutes of Health say that the brain is the key to figuring out those effects.
According to NBC News, researchers at the NIH have been diligently working on several projects to try and ascertain why some patients experience lingering symptoms weeks and even months after the acute infection. Symptoms can include profound fatigue, brain fog, shortness of breath, fevers, and headaches. The goal of the project is to figure out how the coronavirus affects brain tissue by studying the brains of those that unfortunately died from COVID-19.
Yeah, researchers had a sample of 30 brains from people aged 5 to 80. The samples were analyzed using MRI, and the team looked for active virus in the brain tissue, but surprisingly, there was no virus to be found. However, they did find a large amount of inflammation.
Yeah, they also found a protein called fibrinogen, which normally plays a role in blood clotting. However, fibrinogen should not normally be found in the brain. Its presence suggests that there were tiny blood clots in the brain that decreased oxygen levels. The decreased oxygen levels can lead to a lot of things, including brain fog and stroke. While the results of the brain research are significant, what they could mean are only theoretical at this point, and they may not be the only cause of the long-term COVID-19 symptoms.
Yeah, it's super fascinating. Other NIH research is looking at the nervous system changes of those who recovered from COVID-19, lung fluid samples, and imaging of the brain, heart, and lungs. Hopefully, science will prevail swiftly to help those suffering from the most physical effects of the coronavirus. Truly fascinating, Julia. Like, right? I mean, we know, well, one, let's just take a huge step back and say all of this stuff could have been prevented had we acted in a coordinated and central perspective. So I just want to be very clear about that, that our approach was terrible. But now we have folks that are having these microemboli or these clots in their brains, which could be responsible for a lot of the adverse effects that people are feeling after, or the lingering effects rather, that people are experiencing after having COVID.
Yeah, this is so interesting. I mean, I'm so shocked to hear fibrinogen.
Yeah, fibrinogen in the brain.
Yeah, I'm just curious to see what else they're going to find out, you know, in future research. I think all of this is still so very new. So that unexpected finding, I mean, I just can't imagine what else will come from the research. So we'll have to wait and see.
Yeah, we'll continue to follow up on this story. HIV/AIDS reduction goals not met. In 2015, the Joint United Nations Program on HIV/AIDS, also known as UNAIDS, UNICEF, the World Health Organizations, and the United States President's Emergency Plan for AIDS Relief set ambitious goals to slow down and eventually stop the HIV/AIDS epidemic. They rolled out a five-year campaign called Start Free, State Free, AIDS Free. And in July of 2021, the report that measured how successful that campaign was has come out. And unfortunately, no goals were met. Not one. According to NPR, the overall goals aim to bring down the number of new cases, particularly amongst children, teens, and young women by 2020, and to bring up the number of people on HIV treatment. Dr. Mary Mahi, lead of the epidemiology team at UNAIDS and one of the report's authors, is particularly alarmed by the HIV medication statistics for children. We've always managed to get more children on treatment. That's what's shocking and upsetting me. There are several possible reasons why the goals failed to be met. While the report notes that the global COVID-19 crisis has severely disrupted the delivery of services to youth as well as older populations, there are other pre-pandemic issues. It's always been difficult to identify children and adults who are infected and need treatment. This has been especially heightened during the pandemic, as it is hard to test pregnant women to see if they're HIV positive and then to provide treatment to prevent their children from being infected. The report's data suggests that 99,000 children were infected with HIV in 2020 because pregnant or breastfeeding HIV-positive women didn't get diagnosed and treated. Babies born with HIV are at extremely high risk from dying of AIDS. Without treatment, half of these children die by the age of two. Children infected through breastfeeding are also easily missed. There's also the issue of identifying children who need HIV treatment. Even if they are tested, it can take days for diagnostic results to come back, and families don't always follow up to get the diagnosis, making it hard to start treatment. The Associate Director and Chief of the HIV/AIDS section at UNICEF believes that governments and donors simply aren't doing enough to address the HIV/AIDS epidemic in children. The report also included some positive news because there are several strategies already in practice that, if ramped up, could turn the tide in the fight against the HIV/AIDS epidemic. Family testing is one such approach that could lead to more accurate diagnosis of children. Parents who are picking up their own HIV medications are asked to bring their children along to be tested. Experts think scaling up family testing can help get more at-risk children screened, especially in countries with high rates of HIV infection. The report also describes new, simple point-of-care testing machines that make fast same-day HIV results possible at clinics. HIV-positive children and adolescents also struggle with taking HIV medicines, which can taste horrible, cause horrible side effects, and may be hard to store and administer. However, a new medication called dolutegravir has emerged as the first-line defense medication, even for infants as young as 4 weeks old. Dolutegravir comes in a berry flavor and dissolves in water, making it easier and more palatable for kids to take. Even though the results of Start Free, Stay Free, AIDS Free campaign were decidedly dismal, the organizations involved has set new goals designed to reverse current trends and make forward progress with a target date of 2025. They propose a 95-95-95 global AIDS strategy to wipe out the HIV/AIDS epidemic among children, adolescents, and young women. The goals for 2025 include 95% of pregnant women getting HIV tested, 95% of HIV-positive pregnant and breastfeeding women achieve suppressed HIV viral load through treatment, and 95% of at-risk children get HIV tested at age 2 months after breastfeeding ends. The report authors believe governments around the world are not doing enough to make a dent in the epidemic. Hopefully, a more financial and general support can be garnered to really make effective changes. Just as a reminder that COVID-19 and the human immunodeficiency virus do share the same risk factors. Doc Griggs?
Thanks for listening to the Noise Filter Daily Podcast. Remember, get checked, get fit, get moving. And remember to get some rest to boost your immune system. And Doc?
Protect yourself and others by staying home, and please wear masks when you go outside. Remember, health is a human right.
Dirty Wars, and you're listening to KBOO Portland 90.7.
KBOO Community Radio holds open meetings concerning the operations and programming of KBOO in accordance with the requirements of the Communications Act of 1934 and certification requirements of the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. Information about KBOO Community Radio's open meeting policy is available on our website at kboo.fm. Due to the temporary closures of in-station activity at KBOO, meetings will be conducted online via public video conferencing unless otherwise noted. A public link and phone number to attend the meetings are available on our website. The Program Advisory Committee meets on the second Tuesday of the month at 6 p.m. Please visit our website at kboo.fm to verify if a meeting is being held.